Welcome, pudding people, to another episode of Everybody Loves Pudding. I am your host, Ken Seymour. I have a returning guest, a friend of the show, a man that you could call an actor, a man that you could call a magician. I just call him a man for the ages. We have the amazing Rich Manley.
How you doing? Good to be here.
Oh, it's been, what, about 4 years since we had you on the show?
I think it's been about four, you know, at least a good 4 years.
Yeah, that's a lot of time for a lot of interesting things to happen. And I wanted to start this off with maybe the most incredible thing that I saw that happened to you in the time that you were gone. You were able to maybe achieve the dream role of male receptionist. And here comes the boom.
Yes, the ultimate dream role.
I saw that, though. I had to giggle a little bit. It's like, oh, but man, I hope he had a chance to at least meet Henry Winkler, because that would like be a dream for me to get a chance to run into that kind of a legendary actor.
You know, I didn't really meet him, but I believe it was such it's always so hard to remember, but I believe I saw him in passing. But yeah, never got to meet him face to face, unfortunately. Would have been great, though.
Still kind of fun to be involved in a project that is closely associated with your love of martial arts. And did you get to be a fly on the wall, see some of the choreography, and get anywhere involved in that?
I wish I was. No, it was pretty much just very confined to male receptionist, unfortunately.
Well, that's unfortunate, but
I know.
You did involve yourself with a project that got you a little closer to some more physical action. I seem to remember that you were in a project with Mr. Scott Adkins.
Yes. That was pretty fun. Was working with my director friend, Jesse Johnson, and he's done a number of different films with Scott. And this film, you know, it was fun in the sense that I got to do some fights with a fight scene, basically with Scott. And I played, you know, this drug addict who owes Scott and his partner some money. So they break down the door and I go run in, and then we end up having a altercation together, which was really fun. It was fun to choreograph that with Scott.
It always amazes me. There are certain individuals, you know, there's always going to be the action stars, that are going to be known for certain things. And for me, I'll talk to people about Scott Adkins and they'll often go, who? It's like, man, you really need to watch some stuff. But the thing that gets me is he always has this crispness in how he delivers his moves that you don't see a lot in other performers. And does that come through when you're kind of doing the choreography, or is that more of an editing trick?
You know, we do so many different takes that I think it's one of those things that it's just rehearsal after rehearsal. So you do a take and then, you know, it's not so crisp. And then, you know, you keep working on it until it becomes that way. But, you know, because Scott is, you know, a very talented martial artist, and I've studied martial arts as well, you know, his style is a little bit different than mine. So we were able to kind of speak the martial language, so to speak, rather quickly. So we got the scene done pretty fast, opposed to taking too many takes. It just, you know, it took me a little bit of time to dial it down because my character really isn't as, I guess, as proficient, whereas a lot of my skills are more kung fu based and more precise and more, I guess, Jet Li-esque. Mm. And the character is, you know, just a typical street, you know, brawling, you know, Westerner, really, that's just throwing haymakers and, you know, uncontrolled punches and attacks, which actually at times takes more attention to detail to break the habit of actually being a good martial artist. You have to kind of deconstruct and say, okay, well, you know, I'm not going to attack Scott in a way that would be a refined, you know, skill, because that's not the character. He's just this drug dealer. He's throwing random punches and, you know, may get some exchanges in there. But for the most part, Scott is fighting in that refined style, whereas I have to de-refine the style in a way Which is always hard, you know, playing those characters where you gotta kind of like, okay, I know this is the right way to do it. Now I have to play dumb, so to speak. So.
Did they kind of let you find your own way, or did they, it's like, okay, here's how we imagine your character would actually interact, and then you had to kind of take that and do something with it.
No, I mean, it's kind of an unspoken, I guess, way of fighting in the stunt world. I mean, you just know there's always the hero. Who obviously the hero is going to be the lead fighter, so he's going to do a lot more of the intricate choreography, unless it's a Hong Kong style fight or you know, an intricate martial arts piece where the characters are particularly known to be good martial artists, in which case they're both showcasing their skills. But you know, in this context, it's one of those things where, you know, you chat with the director and they say, okay, this is the person you are. You understand how to take punches and how to react to punches and how to react, you know, as a stuntman, how to react to hits and throws and falls and things like that. So you're basically kind of working with your partner, in this case, Scott, with his language of fighting. And just adapting to that, you know, and to his flow, because, you know, it's almost like a dance and he's taking the lead of the dance and you're the partner that's kind of following and, you know, reacting really to what's happening from him. So it is really character based. And, you know, there is a conversation there that's like, okay, well, you know, he's going to fight like this. He's not going to fight like that. So we do have those discussions and talks. And, you know, if it does become too kung fu-y, so to speak, which, you know, Jesse would have to say to me from time to time, "Hey, Rich, you know, you're throwing a, you know, you're being too stylized." And it's like, okay, I gotta remember, I'm just gonna toss out those punches. But for the most part, yeah, we talk it over.
Man, that sounds like it'd be so much fun to put together on something like that. What was maybe your my last question on that particular film, what was maybe your favorite part of being involved with that project?
I think it really was just the martial aspect of it, you know, because I've worked on some other projects that are strictly either acting roles or, you know, they're just dialogue pieces. But I think the action was really cool to be involved with this time, because that is a skill of mine and something that I love to do. So that really, to me, was the highlight, getting to do action.
Yeah, I could definitely see that for sure. Now,
Yeah.
on the other hand, Sleigh Bells, that's a completely different avenue to go down. Tell me
Yes.
a little bit about your part in that particular project.
So that one, Sleigh Bells, basically there's no action except for the action of me basically, you know, dying, which is what the whole scene entails. I mean, I play the boyfriend to one of the characters in the movie. And you know, I'm coming to her rescue, and Krampus is, you know, on the prowl, and he's, you know, just killing everyone. And you know, I break into a cabin and end up, you know, trying to save her and brutally dying, by the way. I enjoy, you know, I enjoyed the being on set and seeing all the construction of the Krampus creature, and it was fun to be there. You know, and interact with people. Always, it's always fun to play a role like that. But the thing I didn't enjoy, which is just a thing that I hate, is the blood. I don't like the sticky, like being covered in the sticky blood. It's just every time that I have to do it, death scene, there's blood on me. I'm always like, just get this stuff off.
I'm
I can't.
dirty. I'm
Yeah.
unclean.
I'm not a fan of that. But it was fun. You know, it was fun.
Did you get a chance to interact at all with the late great Richard Mall?
Yeah, I did. He was in the scene too. You know, watched me die. So we got to interact. But for the most part, you know, after the scene was done, it was just time spent washing off the massive amount of blood that were entailed in my death.
I thought there might have been potentially some amusing backstage stuff because Barry Bostwick was in that production as well. And
Yes.
he's been, it seems, magic adjacent on a few occasions. I seem to remember him being in an episode of Supernatural playing a magician. So I wondered if there's some maybe shared interest that he might have had that you would be able to kind of brush up against.
Yeah, you know, we didn't really get into the magic aspect, and that's funny you bring it up because I didn't really know that. You know, I was kind of I showed up. It was cold. I think we were doing it up in Big Bear, which is up in the mountains, and it was night. It was a night scene, so I was tired and cold, and I ended up showing up, and we just got right to it. There was, you know, very little downtime to chat, but I would have loved to have known that then and actually delved into the magic side. It would have been great.
That would have been fun, but you know, sometimes you got to get to the work and kind of focus on the thing. So you get to focus on magic and other things. So when we talked last, your first season of Culture Shock was not even out yet. It was coming out on Tubi and it was about to be released. Now that first season is done. You're going to be renewed for a second season, which is truly exciting. So now that you've had a chance to really reflect on that first kind of experience, what aspects of the production of that first season are going to affect the second? Did you go, it's like, you know, now that we've done this the first time, I know when we go and do the second season, we need to change this or maybe adapt this in a different way.
Yeah, so we there was a lot of things that we learned from the first season, and there was a lot of hurdles. I mean, there was so much. Our producer, you know, James Houston would often say, you know, it's almost a show in itself just seeing the behind the scenes of what went on, because it's he's like it's and in a way it's almost more interesting because there's so much stuff that's happening that's just bad, you know, and you're trying to deal with it and figure it out. Especially when you're out there on remote travel, there's just safety concerns, but also there's, you know, cameras are either breaking or you're in a higher altitude and you have to deal with that. And there's so many concerns to take into place. Even around the cultures, you know, we've had dangerous situations happen in Africa where we were involved in the middle of tribal warfare, at one, you know, for one tribe. And, James also in the Peru episode was sucked down into a hydraulic in a rapid in the Andes, and he almost didn't surface, you know, when a raft flipped over on us. So, you know, you run into those issues, and we always say, so how can we make this more safe? And, you know, we always try to do that. But at the same time, this next season is delving into the cultural aspect and me following my grandfather's journal that he left me, which were all these places he traveled to, and me basically picking up where he left off and saying, oh, wow, you know, he's kept this journal. These are all the places he visited. These are all the people he saw and did magic for. And the next season kind of still has the journal aspect as the through line of, okay, this is why we're going to these different places. But we wanted to script it less, because the first episode, the pilot, was, you know, scripted in a way that it really was a pilot, and we were experimenting with a bunch of different elements, and there was a lot going on. And then slowly, if you see episode two, episode three, episode four, it's less scripted in a way that things just generally are happening to us. And we really liked that aspect of it over the, you know, the more developed story of what we did in the first episodes of Peru. So the next episode in season one, which I just got back from, is in Bolivia, and we meet these women, these ice climbing and mountaineering women, called the Cholitas Escaladoras, which is refers to climbing women, and they're just miraculous women that are Aymara women, indigenous that women that climb these mountains, and they've climbed the highest mountain near La Paz 100 times, which is a 6,000 meter peak, and they do it in indigenous clothing. They don't wear puffers or anything like you'd see typical mountaineers wearing, which is just a very fascinating story. So we are leaning more toward the stories of the people rather than the through line, so much scripting of the story of my grandfather's journey. It is the inspiration for the show still. It is the inspiration of where we go, but it's talking more this season about the people and, you know, what makes them special and what they believe in and what they do in the various regions that we go to. And that's really what we're leaning into on the show. And of course, magic too. You know, I do magic for them. I'm doing magic for the people, because it is showing how that magic connects everybody. And it was a fantastic experience in Bolivia. That's our first episode of season two, And you know, the magic went great. Everyone loved it. And it was just very inspirational to meet these women that, you know, could deal with these mountains. I got altitude sickness. I mean, I got there and I was a mess the whole trip. I just got back the other day and still recovering. But I hope people see that when they watch the second season, they see that there are inspiring people throughout the world, and these are kind of their stories.
So you're following this journal that your grandfather had. Now, he was a doctor. Is that what
Yes.
brought him to these locations originally, or was he traveling to them for other reasons?
Yeah, so he came basically to, well, he would go to these areas because he would be doing seminars on medicine because he was a doctor. So, you know, in Japan he would give seminars, or Tibet, and then in the Amazon he was seeking out some of the herbs and different medicines that were you know, believed to cure certain diseases deep in the Amazon in the rainforest. And so he would go there. And again, he'd use that magic as a skill to kind of break the ice, you know, and meet people. And you know, that's really what inspired me the most to go on this journey, was the fact that he could use magic, and then it kind of opened the door, and it you know, kind of dispelled any myths anyone have or prejudices anyone had against each other, and they just w would find this common ground. And so that really is the basis of the show.
Well, I'm sure it'll be as, I don't want to use the word saturated. It sounds like a strange term, but it is just kind of it, every little bit of it has that cultural differentiation that really makes things fascinating. I'm sure it will be just as saturated as the first season was with that and really interesting. Now, does this also play into your Diary of Magic tour that you're doing?
Yes, and it's a new development. We actually changed the name. So Diary of Magic was the first name. Name change. It's now the Journal of Mystery. And Journal of Mystery. It's kind of, you know, it's a little bit more mysterious.
I like it.
Yeah, so that does play into it. It's a live stage show that I'm doing. Our first opening show is on July 12th at the Loews Theater in Hollywood. And it really does delve into my experiences around the world, you know, following my grandfather's journal, which is the Journal of Mysteries, talking about the experience I've had with these different cultures, some of the dangers, some of the things that have happened to me, but also the magic I took away from these different regions, you know, shamans who had people swallow needles to exorcise demons in Sri Lanka. I tell a story about that. And then, of course, invite an audience member up and I swallow some needles and then pull them out with a thread tied onto the thread, you know, things like that.
Classic.
So it's talking about what I've experienced and then showing it, you know.
Since you're going with this diary, has there ever been a point when you're looking at this source material where there has been enough of a gap of time and enough of a change culturally where something is written in there that just doesn't present itself as obviously, as maybe your grandfather intended it to seem when he wrote it, it took you some time to kind of get through it and understand what he meant by something.
You know, oftentimes, I mean, as a kid, I was very curious, and I loved Egypt, and I always wanted to travel, and I really wanted to travel to Egypt. And you know, he knew that, and he would have in his study, you know, all these trinkets from places around the world. And I think the one thing that he wanted to teach me, and specifically why he gave me the journal, is to travel and see how everything was connected. You know, I remember him doing the very first card trick for me, and that was in his study. And I was about 10 years old. And I remember I snuck in there. I wasn't allowed to go in there. That was kind of an off-limits thing. But it was this Indiana Jones, you know, esque museum with all these old trinkets, explorer vibe everywhere. There's maps on his desk. And he caught me in there, and you know, he wasn't really mad. He said, you know, I knew I'd find you here. And he showed me a sleight of hand trick, which was very difficult to do. It was a vanishing card trick. And when you have small hands, it's almost impossible to do it with the size of cards, because you're hiding a playing card. And, you know, at family get-togethers, I would show everyone the trick that he had taught me and try to get better and better. And obviously, it was terrible because everyone could see the card when I was trying to make it vanish. But he would always watch and say, you know, I'm just proud of you because you had the patience to stick with it. And he said, you know, that's, I think, you know, now looking back, that's really what he wanted to teach me was that magic takes patience, very much like some of the things he experienced on his travels and in his journal. He talks about, you know, connections and patience. And I think, you know, that is one of the qualities of a complete explorer that Ernest Shackleton, who was an Irish explorer in the golden age of exploration in the Arctic, he wrote about four qualities of an explorer, and one of them was patience. And my grandfather really loved Shackleton. And I think that was one thing that, you know, because I'm in my haste to go and see these places, he constantly stressed to just take a moment and actually enjoy and see and experience these people. Because when you do experience a community in Africa and then experience a community in South America, you start to see how similar they are. And especially when you do magic for them, because you see the reactions are all pretty much the same, but it brings us back to that child wonderment of what could be. And, you know, it took me some time to kind of see that in my grandfather's writing was the connection and the patience, really. And so, you know, the rest is kind of history, I guess, you know.
With this tour, are you going to be keeping it mostly to close-up magic? Are you going to be doing some set pieces? What's going to be the focus, or is it going to be a blend of everything?
It is an intimate venue, so the stage show, where the whole thing is looking to have, you know, an intimate audience. I did do a prior show that had a larger group of people, 150, you know, stage. Where the stage is bigger, but this is smaller. We're basically targeting areas, hotels, and venues that can hold an intimate audience of about 60 people. And you know, you get invited, you get the tickets, and you come and you watch this performance that is both close up, but also certain stage elements. You know, I do bring people up on audience and from the audience on stage because I want to interact with people and show them firsthand what I had witnessed from some of these people. And then, of course, you have more of the demonstrative, you know, magic illusions where everyone's sitting down, and then I'll do something that's a little grander. But for the most part, it is a very intimate, you know, close-up style show explaining, you know, wow, this is what happened to me, this is what I experienced, and this is what I saw that I'm now going to show you.
That kind of close-up magic can have, I always feel like it has more of an impact to me, just because with the stage pieces, I love everything related to magic. And a lot of people we've had conversations like, you're always trying to figure out how the trick works. Doesn't that kind of break it for you? It's like, no, that's the best part. I want to try and see if I can get in the head of the person that's creating the illusion and see if I can figure out how they did. How would I do it if I were to be in the same kind of situation, but with a close up kind of a presentation? It's less about that and more about execution, about speed and being able to get that connection with the audience member so that they become part of the whole experience. What's your favorite part about that kind of close-up magic experience?
I really think it is the interaction with people. You know, with the stage performance, I mean, it really is a performance. When you're doing it on stage, you're performing in a way. But when you're doing close up, you're interacting, which I think to me takes a little bit more. I mean, they're different skills, I would say, but there's a lot more that you have to pay attention to when you have someone that close. You know, it is more of an intimate misdirection because you're not just misdirecting the one person that is up there with you if there's a group of people, but you have to misdirect them in a way that you're also misdirecting the audience. So you have to make sure you're aware of your angles for not just the person you're performing for, but for the general audience that is out there as well. So I think it takes a lot of, it takes a certain mindset to really say, okay, you know, I've got to do this in front of someone. I've got to do sleight of hand, but I have to use this psychology. I have to perform and I have to incorporate all these elements into one to do something right in front of someone's eyes. And I think that's what I love about it the most is that it's challenging. It's a challenge. But also the reward at the end is that everyone, if it's done well, is, like, wow, that's insane because you are doing it right in front of them. So to them, it's almost like, well, how could he do that? If you're on stage, people could say, oh, there's mirrors or there's things we can't touch or see. We're so far removed. But if they're right there in front of you, it's hard to kind of explain what you're seeing, which is something that I think is really powerful in close up.
Definitely. Do you get a chance to kind of, it's not really competition, but scope out other professionals in your field, see some of the up and comers, the ones that are trying to put their own particular spin on magic and the presentation? Has anybody kind of influenced you, some of these new people, or at very least impressed you with the way that they're doing their thing?
Yeah, I would say there is a lot of magicians out there who are lesser known, and they've been very inspiring as well. I mean, obviously you have the known magicians, but there's a lot of very impressive cardists who are, card manipulators, so they're playing with cards and stacking cards and things like that, which, I find very impressive. I like magicians who are doing a lot of sleight of hand, whereas typically the general audience, it's funny because in the circles of magicians, we always say, some sleight of hand might take years and years to do, but the audience generally reacts stronger to things that are just self-working, that are easy, that anyone could do. And that's because a lot of times people don't understand that, you could be doing something that's a numbers thing, like, okay, think of a card, you're counting down, and then you find that card, and it's almost impossible to explain and even stumps other magicians. But when you're doing sleight of hand, there's always like, oh, well, maybe they did that, maybe they did that. And so that normally gets a bigger reaction to then some of these more elaborate things like palming cards or stealing cards or doing all these things. And so you spend years learning a skill, and then at the end it's like, oh, well, someone comes up who does this party trick and people are like, wow, how did you do that? And you're like, well, I just spent 10 years on this. No, but it happens a lot. And I think, that's why what impresses me as a magician is just those magicians that do a lot of sleight of hand and really practice on that, because I know how hard it is to do it. And so from a magician's perspective, when I'm watching them, I kind of, obviously I know what they're doing, but I'm watching to see how smoothly they do it and how effortlessly they do it with misdirection, where it's like, okay, that's takes tremendous talent to do. So
now I'm sure a part of it is also having quality equipment to be able to practice with. And I'm under the impression that maybe potentially somebody might have some new stuff that you could get access to help you become the next big magician.
Yes. Yeah. No, I'm glad you brought that up, because I do. We are releasing, we've just released some playing cards with the USPCC, which is bicycle cards. So we used a bicycle finish for these custom cards that I designed, a premium air cushion finish. It's a lot of the air cushion finish that David Blaine uses on his cards. And, they use them on a lot of cards that magicians use. And it pays homage to my grandfather, but also explorers throughout the world. And it has on the court cards, there are like Ernest Shackleton and Jacques Cousteau. Their portraits or their likeness is the court cards. And then the jokers are the likeness of my grandfather with a special reveal. There's three jokers and there's a reveal in one of them where I teach a card effect that you can do at home. So if you go on the website that we have, which is www.expeditionrich.com, you can buy the decks alone, you can buy a signed deck, or you can buy a combo, which is a deck plus a download. And that download will show you an effect that you can do specifically with this deck. And it'll teach you sleight of hand, different moves that you could practice on your own to impress friends, family. And so that's all included in it.
Now, be careful. If you do get this, you might become, let us say, enamored and want to keep doing it
yes.
forever and ever.
That's what happened to me. So you never know.
It's good stuff. Now, the last time we talked, I told you about how we have our own obsession a little bit with comic books and, you know, what character you might play. And you said that, that Gambit might be the direction that you might go. Now, there was a film that just had Gambit in it that came out not that long ago. I didn't know if you had the chance to see it. And I would like to get your opinion if you think this gentleman did a good job or not, because it was Channing Tatum in the most recent Deadpool film that did the role himself. Do you think he did it justice?
I enjoyed it. I think that he did. You know, I mean, it's one of those things where it's always like, to me, when I watch anyone who's not a martial artist per se, and they're learning, you know, like when actors are learning martial arts, I'm always like, I'm very particular, because I, you know, martial arts is a very important skill to me that I've trained since I was 10 and I still do. So it's always like, okay, are they going to pull it off? They're going to do a stunt double. What are they going to do? But I think, you know, it was very impressive that, coming to the playing field as a dancer, you know, he had the moves to do it. So I think he did a pretty good job at it. You know, I don't really have any critiques on it, you know.
Well, it's just always good to see somebody that loves a character of some kind get the chance to actually finally achieve that. I saw that when I watched that, my, you know, the friends I was talking to, I was like, why did you mention Rich when you're talking about this? It's like, I will get to it later. we talk about it. There's a reason. It made me think of it. It's like, oh yeah, you gotta do that. One of the other questions we asked you last time was about, you know, food, pizza specifically. But with the traveling that you're doing, one of the things that I thought of was, well, you get the chance to be exposed to cuisine that a lot of us will just not get the chance to have access to. Of the places that you have traveled for this show, or even somewhere else, is there something that you had that you had never tried before that you thought was particularly excellent?
So I have to say, I'm a very bland eater. So if I had to say that there was an excellent food, I think I have more stories of the food being more terrifying, I guess, because, you know, we try to eat things, or on the show, a couple of episodes, we ate things that were, you know, I was like, guys, come on, you know, we eat some Mopani worms in Africa, which these giant, very, you know, like thick worms that are, you know, you eat them and they like explode in your mouth. That was a horrifying experience. You know, in Bolivia, you know, it was crazy because the guys and the team were looking for the weirdest food for me to eat.
Oh,
you
no.
know, there was like, I think someone brought up the fact that there was possibly in Bolivia, you know, they ate like bull's penis, and they were like, we're going to have you eat that. And I was like, the whole time, just like, guys, every time we pass by a food vendor, they're talking about this stuff. And I'm like, I don't know if I can handle it. Let's just move on from the weird food subject. But I did end up eating in this most recent episode, which I'll share, a cow's heart, which was...
That's actually really good.
Yeah, I was pretty terrified again. You know, I tried it, and... you know, our fixer kept saying, if you don't like it, do not spit it out in front of them, because they may chase you with a knife. So I was like, okay. You know, and I was eating it, and it had this very soft, I mean, it wasn't tender. It wasn't like eating, you know, like a sirloin.
No,
it was, it was a very soft feeling, and I just couldn't get out of my head that I'm eating a human heart. A cow heart. And I just kept thinking, okay, this is what a heart looks like. This is what I'm eating. It just, in my head, I was like, okay, this is this beating heart. I'm eating it. And I don't know. I so to answer your question, there hasn't been too many food items that get pushed in front of me that I'm like, oh, that was fantastic. It's mostly the opposite.
Always
So
produces the same sound. You get the plate and you just go, oh,
yeah,
oh man.
exactly. You know, I'm starving, and then it's like, okay, here we go.
Oh no, I understand that. My dad was a chef, and the first time he got me to have cow tongue, that was a struggle to get me to accept that because I had the same kind of reaction, but broke down over time a little bit. A little bit. I still insects. I can't do that, but I'm sure if it's processed, maybe. All right, one final question. I know you don't have a lot of time on your hands, so I want to make it good. This is a new one that we started asking ever since your last episode. It's kind of a hypothetical. So
Right, let's hear it.
you're wandering around Los Angeles. You decide to stop by a cafe, have a little coffee or something, sit down, and all the tables have these little lamps on them. It's like, oh, it's a beautiful lamp, and you just rub some dirt off of it. Poof, a genie comes out. The genie is wearing a business suit and sunglasses and sitting at the table next to you. It's like, ah, you freed me. You get to have the normal three wishes that you would expect, but I'm an LA genie, so the only wishes that I actually give out are wishes to be able to work with somebody that you've always wanted to work with. Three individuals, living or dead, who are some people that you would love to work with?
I have to pick three or just one?
Oh, you can pick three.
I have to pick three. Pick three. Well, I you know one for sure is I've always admired Tom Cruise's work. And then working on Night and Day. I never got the chance to work with him on that movie. Again, I was working more with Cameron Diaz. But I'd say Tom Cruise, just because of the passion for filmmaking and the work ethic,
That's a good one.
and the action that he incorporates in doing his own stunts and really studying everything, which I admire, from my own perspective. And then the other two, maybe, I grew up watching Bear Grylls. I think that would be kind of interesting,
Nice. That would be
like a
really
Bear
cool.
Grylls, special with myself and in incorporating magic, but the adventure element too,
That would be
because
really cool.
and then the third, man, you put me on the spot here.
Have to get these questions out in
Oh,
advance.
I will say I've always liked, and it's this weird thing, I've always liked Sigourney Weaver's work, because I
Oh.
just think she's just a badass, especially since Alien.
Yeah.
It's funny because I always say this, but in Holes, when she plays like the villain in Holes, I don't know. I think working with her would be
She's
great.
fantastic. I mean, and she can do anything. She did in Galaxy Quest, went completely against type and was so good.
Yes, I know. I know.
Well, that is an excellent set. Now, listeners, do not forget to check out the second season coming up of Culture Shock. Still going to be on Tubi, right?
It's on Tubi, but it's also coming to Apple TV. It should be on Hulu and other streaming services, so watch out.
And we're coming up soon on that. And where is your tour, your newly renamed tour, going to be taking you?
So, Diary of Magic, first show, the premiere is July 12th in Hollywood at the Loews Hotel. And then after that, they're looking at venues in Cincinnati, West Virginia, Hawaii, the Bahamas. So if you want to stay tuned to know more about when that's happening, you can go to www.expeditionrich.com or www.wiggleroomentertainment.com. Wiggle Room is the parent company of the touring show.
Fantastic. Well, that will be a treat if you can get a chance to see this nice gentleman perform. I know it for sure. Thank you for taking the time to come back on the show and fill us in with what's been going on and some of the cool stuff that's going to be happening. And I hope things go completely atypical. And the next place you go for Culture Shock gives you a nice stack of pancakes and It's just some eggs or something.
Yes. Yeah. It'll be great.
It will be great.